Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
8:16 now, our WWL Blue Runner Gumbo opinion poll this hour is asking you, do you know someone who struggled with opioid abuse? And cast your vote at WWL.com. As it stands now, 70% are saying yes. Somebody texted in and said, yes, they do know somebody. Their sister has had problems with opioids. Well, if you look in at the news in Ohio, drug companies have settled with the state of Ohio, some drug lawsuits to the tune of $260 million. But were they afraid of going to trial, or if they had, what could have been the consequences? And is this anywhere near enough to compensate Ohio for, as I understand it, is one of the worst places in the country for opioid abuse and deaths? Tim Litton joins us now, professor of law at Georgia State. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Tim, what is the legal background, if you will, for the opioid suits, and where does the state have the right to sue drug companies when people overdose on their drugs?
States and localities started suing opioid manufacturers and distributors going back to the early 2000s, and there are a couple sort of key dates in this history. In 2004, there was a settlement in West Virginia between opioid manufacturers and the state of West Virginia for $80 million. And then fast forward to 2007, Purdue Pharmaceuticals, which was a major producer of opioids, paid a $600 million fine in a federal prosecution. And then most recently, just this year, in Oklahoma State Court, there were settlements with Purdue and Teva, who are manufacturers of the drug. Purdue settled for $270 million, and Teva settled for $85 million. And one case actually went to trial against Johnson & Johnson, who was primarily a distributor and did some opioid manufacturing. And in that trial, there was a verdict against the company for $572 million. And I think that sent a big warning shot across the bow of the pharmaceutical industry. And that's why we see this last-minute settlement right on the eve of trial in Ohio. In Ohio, we have about 2,400 government cases that are all consolidated from around the country, and they're in one federal court for working out some of the basic issues in this litigation. And one case in Cleveland was about to go forward to trial, sort of the first test case in this large collection. And on the eve of trial, there was a settlement between four distributors and a manufacturer for $260 million. And basically what it looks like is there's a lot of fear in the industry that, you know, especially after the Oklahoma verdict of $572 million against Johnson & Johnson, that going to trial is a really high-stakes game. One other thing to just give you a sense is that there's rumor of a deal, a nationwide deal in the works, where there would be a complete nationwide deal between the industry on the one hand and cities, states, and localities on the other for $48 billion. Now, that's just being worked out now in principle, but that agreement would be between state attorneys general and the pharmaceutical companies, both manufacturers and distributors and retailers.
What kind of defense in the previous case, because this was a settlement, I guess it was in West Virginia, did the drug manufacturer, well, let me take a break for traffic here. When we come back, we'll pick it up. What kind of defense did the drug company mount in terms of not being liable for the opioid overdose problems that have occurred there? West Virginia, a terrible place as well for that. 820 traffic now, WWL. 825, Tommy Tucker, WWL. It is opioid. There is an opioid summit in New Orleans, and we're going to talk to a couple of people from the LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine. Somebody texted in here, wants to know, Tim, what happens to the money that states get from suing pharmaceutical companies?
Well, the current settlement that they're trying to work out, the global settlement, would involve $48 billion, $22 billion, half that money would be cash payments over 18 years to states to reimburse them for the costs of dealing with the crisis and probably to, you know, fuel more treatment programs. And $26 billion of that would be for treatment medications, to deal with addiction. So, you know, the basic idea here is that the companies are supposed to be both paying money to compensate for the states, you know, all of the expenses that they've put together to have to pay for treatment, and also to help fund treatment into the future. We know, however, from the tobacco settlement that, you know, when you pay money into state coffers, it often finds a way of going elsewhere. And so there's talk about creating a national trust fund where all the money would be deposited, and then states and localities would apply for that money for specific treatment programs, and it wouldn't just go into state coffers, because we saw a lot of tobacco settlement money going into highway funds and school projects as opposed to tobacco control. So there are concerns about that as well.
If I'm a big pharmaceutical company or one of the ones involved in the opioid crisis, and I say, you know what, I don't want to go to court, I'll settle for, let me pick a crazy number, $500 million, right? Do I have any say-so in how that money's used, or is that completely, or could you craft a legal document that way, or is it always completely up to the attorney general of that state or the governor or whomever?
You know, settlements don't really work that way. Usually what happens is that the plaintiffs, you know, who are bringing the lawsuit, demand a certain amount of money in damages, and that money in damages can be used in a variety of ways, and there's not usually any attempt on the, you know, part of the defendant who's paying that money to try and control it. The primary job of the defendant is to pay whatever it takes to get rid of the lawsuit and to get back to business, because it's very hard to operate a business, whether it's a pharmaceutical company or any other kind of company, if you have a big unknown number that involves your liability exposure. It's just very hard to figure out how to plan a budget and move the business forward if you could be liable for anywhere from $20 million to $1 billion. So what the companies are looking to do is to take what's now a big unknown risk of what they might have to pay out and turn it into a specific determinate number and then move on.
You know what I did not hear from you, Tim, and maybe I missed it, was any sort of compensation for people that have already died. Would it be the governmental agency that gets the reimbursement for what they spent dealing with this? And is anybody entitled to any kind of damages for this product that resulted in their loved one dying, et cetera?
There were originally a lot of lawsuits by individuals, and there still are some. The problem with lawsuits by individuals is that the people who died generally misused the drug, and so that's generally a defense to these sorts of lawsuits. And the problem is that we had the same trouble with smoking, that, you know, people were accepting the risk of smoking addiction because the information was out there. So individual suits are much harder to win. You don't have that kind of defense when you have a government entity bringing it. So if the county or the state brings a lawsuit, you can't turn around and say the county or the state was misusing the drug. They weren't using the drug at all. The argument there is that the company was creating a public nuisance, and that the government had to pick up the tab for that. And that's why you're not seeing so much individual compensation in these lawsuits, but instead money going for, you know, reimbursement to cities and prevention going forward.
It just seems to me that, and I know what's legal is not always right, and what's right is not always legal, but this all started because it was an irresponsible act on the part of the pharmaceutical companies that put out a drug that was instantly addictive, or not in every case, and that was addictive, dangerously addictive, let's put it that way. And if that's the case, then how can you say somebody irresponsibly used it, because you're admitting that you made a product that was prone to that anyway?
Well, I hear you. I mean, I think in cases where people were legitimately using the drug and being addicted, those lawsuits are more likely to succeed, although we haven't seen much success in that department. But, you know, a lot of the cases are brought by people who started their addiction through misuse. The other thing is that, you know, the facts are just so much stronger in a public nuisance case. To prove a public nuisance case, you have to show that the company did something that endangered the safety of others or the public health. And, you know, to give you an example, during 10 months in 2007, one distributor alone, McKesson, shipped 3 million prescription opioids to a single pharmacy in West Virginia in a town that only had 400 residents.
Mm-hmm.
So that's clearly an oversupply of this drug, sort of dumping huge amounts of opioids in a place that couldn't conceivably ever use that much. Or, you know, the state of Oklahoma claimed that the Purdue company sold in 2015 326 million pills in the state. That's 110 pills per person, including women, children, and, you know, everybody in the whole population, not even those using opioids. So those are facts that make it look really bad for the pharmaceutical companies. Those are much easier lawsuits to win, it's looking like, than lawsuits being brought by individuals who are addicted.
Thank you, Tim. I appreciate your time as always, and I hope you have a good weekend.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
You bet. Tim Litton, professor of law at Georgia State. It is the week for an opioid summit in New Orleans. Next half hour, we will...
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.